Uh-oh.
Hey, Brian, you might want to get a couple of those chairs that's around the corner and set them up.
Go in here.
No.
We got three legs back here.
There's a couple of those.
What did he say?
The little chairs. They're 2 feet tall.
A
little red.
Yeah.
That's one of those
broken
chairs.
You have
to sit. No, Mama Jane. Mark, we may have to move if those people are still gone. We may have to switch
to
the...
Your
mom and dad's
not back yet either.
Yeah, so we may have to see if we
switch
classes.
I
wonder how
to pull
that one over
there.
Without you, Brandon.
Kick them out.
We'll
take it.
Or whether or not we buy it. I mean, is there... Oh, there's not a wall there anymore, is there?
No, I mean the other first...
Or the other side.
The other hallway.
Oh.
Or we may have to switch back to this room.
You got the inside scoop, so let me know.
Could claim the auditorium.
No, we're not doing that. I can promise you that. All right, thanks for coming, everybody. Ron, would you mind leading a prayer to get started?
Yeah, I do. Heavenly Father, thank you for this day. Thank you for the opportunity to take a break from our schedules to study your word and be with like-minded brothers and sisters. Please be with Brian as he conducted the class and us that we may retain what is taught tonight, what is discussed to help become better servants of yours. Thank you for everything in Jesus' name. Amen.
All right, does anybody have any questions or thoughts or anything about what we discussed last time? Do you agree, disagree with what we talked about? I'll tell you what, I don't want to be that fan. I like my phone.
Sit over next year.
How you turn on the
switch. All right, so last time we started, I just gave a brief kind of overview, just kind of an introduction to the book, and then we kind of got talking about we ended up talking about moralism. What is moralism?
We can earn our way, favor with God through earn our way.
Yeah, and I presented the idea. I don't know that it's 100%, but I mean it's something I feel like you can draw out of the book anyway from Job's character that he. Through several different examples, we talked about how he had a relationship with God, and God saw that he was blameless, saw that he tried to stand for what's right, and we discussed the difference between being blameless and being sinless. And like our elders are blameless, but they're not sinless, and God never said that Job was sinless. He said that Job was blameless. And we discussed the idea of that Job was offering sacrifices for his children, and we compared him to Noah, and it said the exact same things about Noah, that he was blameless, he stood against evil, but it also said of Noah that he walked with God. So I was kind of trying to build a case, and I'll continue a little bit further tonight, that Job did have a relationship with God, but he also was very dependent on his own works. And when the first set of calamities beset him, he doesn't talk to God at all. If you look at the wordings, he talks about God. From naked I came from the mother's womb, naked I shall return. God taketh and God taketh away. And we talked about how hopefully all of our mindset would be if something like that befell us, we would want to, like, and we give examples of Jeremiah and others and Hezekiah that spoke directly to God that when something happened to them. So there was some sort of disconnect, I feel like, with Job. And I think that we're building a case to that. And I feel like as you continue through the book, you see Job change from talking about God to directly talking to God by the end of the book. And at the end of the book, he does come around to admit, you know, he doesn't know everything and he does have sin. And it never talks about that there's a particular exact sin that caused this to beset him. And we also talked about that with the idea of moralism, you have the idea of his works, the things that he was doing, and he gives this big long list in Job 29 of all the wonderful things that he's doing for God. And those things very well were accurate. He was doing all those things. All of us can make a list of the things that we do for God. But if you're depending on the things that you do for God to have a relationship with you, is that going to work out right for you? What do we depend on? Huh? Yeah, mercy, grace. He does expect us to have works. He lays out all the things that he expects us to do. But we can't depend on that to be our salvation. So that's kind of a brief kind of overview of what we talked about on Sunday. Kind of the idea that Job had the idea of his good works and a good God should equal a good life, and this shouldn't be said in him. But and his friends had the idea of there's a good God, and your bad works, something you had to have done, equals a bad life. Something, there's got to be a reason why this happened to you. So we ended up on the idea of moralism, the idea that somebody can earn their way into God's grace through their moral deeds. It says in Psalms 139, O Lord, you have searched me and know me. You know my sitting down and my rising. You understand my thoughts afar off. You comprehend my path and my lying down, and you are acquainted with all my ways. For there is no a word on my tongue, but behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. I guess at the very end of the class, too, we were also talking about that Satan came to God, but God already knew beforehand that Satan was going to ask. God's the one that brings up, have you considered my servant Job? There's no, let's place a wager on this guy Job, you know, to see if he'll fall. God's the one that knows beforehand that Satan's going to go after him, and he knows that Job is going to need to be tested, and you see through the book that the testing changes his outlook on God. So, that's where we end up. And Noah came up to me after class and was talking about the idea that we talked about, that, you know, you always think about Job being the one that's caught between this, between God and Satan, but who's really the one caught in the middle? Satan, because Satan's the one that goes after him. God's the one that brings it up. God's the one that knows both ends of the stick. He knows what Job's going to happen to Job, and he knows that Satan was going to go after him. So he's the one that allows this to happen, but it's for Job's own good. So I want to think about a little bit about the book of Judges. A couple of years ago, maybe not that long ago, but Curtis and I taught a class on Judges across the hall. But what is a continual theme in the book of Judges? What happens?
Cycle of sin.
That's right, exactly. The people turn their backs on God. What's God do?
Punishes them.
What's the people do?
Repent.
And over and over and over for 30-some chapters, I think. I mean, it's kind of the same theme. The people sin, and God corrects them, and they return back to God. Well, and God's about a relationship. And in the book of Judges, God let evil people happen to them so that they were chasing, the evil that they were chasing after, God turned them over to it and said, okay, if this is what you want to do, go for it. And he allows them to chase their sin, and then he sends another nation in, and then they realize their error, and they return back to God. In 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 10 and 12, it says, and with all unrighteousness, deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this reason, God will send them a strong delusion, that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who do not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. And in Hebrews 12, 6, it says, For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son he receives. We all understand that God disciplines us in different ways for each of us. What may work for me may not work for Amanda, and what may work for Amanda may not work for Jason. I mean, God knows us intimately. He knows everything about us, and he knows the thing that's going to turn our heart, hopefully try to turn our heart back to him when we're in sin. He disciplines those who he loves. But those who turn their back on God, what's God do? He allows you to go. I mean, if you're going to turn your back on God, he's going to allow you to go. Of course, he obviously wants you to return, and he'll make attempts to make that happen. Just like the story of the lost sheep. He left the 99 to find the one. He'll allow you to go into your sin. If that's what the course you decide you want to take, he'll let you go. And we have a responsibility to each other when we see that happen, for us to reach out to each other and try to help each other out. To those who want to follow God, well, God will allow suffering on occasion to bring us back. And that's just, I mean, I don't have a good explanation for that. I mean, we talked about at the beginning of this class that one of the recurring themes to this whole book is why people want to ask, why do good people suffer? And I think Mark and I will touch on that some, but like I said, everyone suffers, and we're called to partake in the sufferings of Christ. And James tells us that suffering builds our character. It tests us, So there's not an answer for that, and God never answers in the entire book. He never gives Job an answer as to why this happened to him. But I think by the end of the book, Job learns what his relationship with God needs to be. I presented the case that I think Job lost his way, but he didn't lose his way like we normally think somebody falls away. You know, I've fallen away twice, I think, maybe two or three times. And I'm not proud to say that, but, I fell away like we would always think. I went out and partied and did my own thing, and that's what we always think about somebody that falls away is going to be partying and living a hedonistic life and sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I mean, that's what we think about, right, when somebody's fallen away from God. But when we think about the story of the prodigal son, that's exactly what the first son did, right? He went out, lived loose, and did whatever he wanted to do. But that's the point. God was teaching Job a lesson about being a moralist, and that's just as dangerous as being a hedonist. Because a moralist, if you fall into the trap of moralism, which I think us as Christians can fall into all the time, and we don't really think that we're there. Because we can think, well, I'm doing, I'm not cussing, I'm not drinking, I'm not partying. But we have a real tendency to look at the people that are living a hedonistic lifestyle, and what can we think about them sometimes? Well, I'm not doing all that stuff. I'm doing pretty good, I'm living all right, at least. But the point is both sons in the story were prodigal sons. The younger son was living a hedonistic lifestyle, partying it up, living loose. The younger son, what's the younger son, or I'm sorry, the older son, say to the father when the younger son returns? He says, look at me. I've been here all this time, and I've served you faithfully day after day after day. What was he counting on?
The reward of his good work.
The reward of his good works. He was like, look at me. I've done all this stuff for you. So they were both prodigal sons. So the trap that I feel like Job was falling into was counting on his good works, and he was doing all these great things for God. But he needed to learn how to have a relationship with God. C.S. Lewis wrote in his book, The Problem of Pain, prostitutes are in no danger of finding their present life so satisfactory that they can't turn to God. The proud, the greedy, the self-righteous are in that danger. Can we be proud pretty easy and not necessarily think that we're doing a bunch of things wrong? I'm a proud person. I mean, that's just the facts of the matter. I may not be drinking, I may not be doing all these things anymore, but I struggle with pride, and I think everybody could admit that if they came down to it. And as Americans, we don't want to admit that we're greedy, but when you go to another, and I don't consider myself greedy, but I live a lifestyle far beyond what I need. That's for sure. And the self-righteous, can we be fall into that trap pretty easily and still think we're doing all these good works, we're coming to church every Sunday, but is it pretty easy to be self-righteous when you look at somebody on the street corner doing their thing or whatever? It's pretty easy. And that's a pretty easy trap for all of us to fall into. It's easy to say, I did all the right things. I said all the right prayers. And God blessed me because I worked the system perfectly. No joke could say that, but God said, no, you didn't. I'll give you over to yourself who you truly follow. So God gave Job over to Satan to realize he was lost in himself. He became a moralist just as the prodigal son was a hedonist. So the book has a really deep, important meaning for us as Christians today, that Jesus came to convict moralists and hedonists, people that feel like they're doing the good works of God, and people that are out living their life however they want. And in Matthew 23, somebody want to read verse 25 through 28? Mark, can you get that in my name?
I think this is good to get. 23.
25 through 28.
What chapter, I'm sorry?
23.
23, 25. Yes, through 28. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you clean the outside of the cup of the dish, but inside they're full of robbery and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisee, first clean the outside of the cup and of the dish, so that the outside of it may become clean also. Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which on the outside appear beautiful, but inside they're full of dead men's bones and all uncleanliness. Even so, you too outwardly appear righteous to men, but inwardly you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness.
Here did Jesus have a lot harsher words for us? The Pharisees and the Sadducees, or the woman caught in adultery? Scribes and Pharisees. What's the easier trap for us as Christians to fall into? More like the scribes and Pharisees. I mean, we're trying to do what's right, but there's a danger sometimes that when we lose sight of our relationship with God and we start to depend on all the good works that we have, and instead of nurturing the relationship we have with God, we can fall into the sin of pride and moralism daily if we're not watching ourselves. Romans 2:11 says that there's no partiality with God. And, we can know that we're no better than him or her, but we can be just as lost in sin as somebody that we can be self-righteously saying, they're definitely doing something, on all outward appearances.
I think Romans 2:11 also is, that he does not show partiality. It's also another thing, Well, we say, why does the righteous person have to suffer? Because God does not show partiality.
Yeah, exactly.
That's one of my, in the first chapter of Job, God makes a point out twice that Job is a perfect, like man. Depending on, I guess, what version you use or blameless. But, yeah, he suffered all these horrible things, where we ourselves, we know we're not blameless. We know that that's probably not what God would say about us, that we're blameless or upright. So that I always think that, that he points that out because he wants us to know nobody's immune to suffering.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sorry, I just keep going on and on, but if somebody has a comment or something, just raise your hand and catch my attention. So if you could look at the book of Judges as the Israelites were acting like hedonists, but you can look at the Job as he was acting like a moralist. But they're equally wrong with God. All God had to do to Israel, and this kind of sounds weird, that all he had to do was let another nation capture him. But think about what God had to do to get Job back. He had to take Job all the way to the bottom of the barrel. That he had to lose his family. He had to lose his livelihood. Himself, he was afflicted. But it woke him up. And he realized that, who God was and what his relationship with him needed to be. But we can be assured as Christians that if we lose our way, God will show up and he'll do whatever he needs to do to restore us, whether it's through other people here or some sort of trial or like this, or, you know, there's, God uses any number of ways to get our attention. So finally we get to Job chapter 40, and Job agrees to finally be silent, but he still doesn't seem to get it. God wasn't upset with Job accusing him. He was upset with the motive behind it. God doesn't just want actions or works. He wants to have good motives behind them. And he spends two more chapters grilling Job to get him to realize that God is a personal God. He's an active God. And he wants to be loved. And he wants us to love him. When you get to chapter 42, Job finally understands. And God blesses him again because... And Job finally understands that God blessed him because he loved him, not because he earned it through his good works. Up until this point, Job says, I've only heard of God, now I see God. That God's a person, personal being, a loving being, with a personality. He goes great lengths to save us from ourselves. Even Satan was wrong about Job. He thought that Job didn't love God, or that Job loved God because of what?
His wealth.
Right, because of his blessing, because of his wealth. But that wasn't the reason that Job loved God. And I don't want anyone in here to misunderstand that. I'm not saying that Job didn't have the best intentions, just like everybody here. We all have good intentions to serve God. I'm just trying to make the point that through our good intentions, sometimes we can lose our way and be caught up in our own selves instead of the relationship with God. When Job was only ready for death is when God could wake him up. And God only allowed Satan to go so far. Have you guys ever heard of Tim Keller? He's a Christian writer. He writes some really good books. And he wrote that God only allowed Satan enough rope to hang himself in this story. Satan wanted to destroy Job, but God wanted to benefit Job. God is always in control and sees the bigger picture for us. So, before we get into chapter 1, I did want to just look at one thing at the end of the book. And you might think this is minor, and it may be, but I think it is significant as an example of a change you see in Job. In ancient culture, did women have the same rights as men? Absolutely not. Did they receive an inheritance? Do you think if this wouldn't have happened to Job, that his first set of daughters that died would have received an inheritance? I don't either. But what's it say at the very end of Job when he gets some more sons and daughters? He gave them the daughters an inheritance equal with the sons. Was that culturally wrong in his day and time? Was that going against the norm of the culture? But did that matter to Job anymore? What did it matter to Job now? Doing what was right and serving God despite what the cultural norms may be or his works. He decided that his daughters were equal with his sons and that they deserved. He wanted to do what was right in the eyes of God. All right, so that's kind of what I have for an introduction. So now we're going to start looking at chapter 1 and... I can get my notes straightened up here. And then we'll read through chapter 1, and then on Sunday, Mark will start with chapter 2. All right, so let's read chapter 1. It's a pretty short chapter, and I'll read it. There was a man in the country of Uz named Job. He was a man of perfect integrity who feared God and turned away from evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. His estate included 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yokes of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large number of servants. Job was the greatest man among all the peoples of the East. His sons used to have banquets, each at his house in turn. They would send an invitation to their 3 sisters and eat and drink with them. Whenever a round of banqueting was over, Job would send for his children and purify them, rising early in the morning to offer burnt offerings for all of them. For Job thought, perhaps my children have sinned, cursing God in their hearts. This was Job's regular practice. One day the Son of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with him. The Lord asked Satan, "Where have you come from?" "From roaming through the earth," Satan answered him, "and walking around on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? No one else on earth is like him, a man of perfect integrity who fears God and turns away from evil." Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you placed a hedge around him, his household, and everything he owns? You have blessed the work of his hands, and the possessions are spread out in the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he owns, and he will surely curse you to your face." "Very well," the Lord said, told Satan. "Everything he owns is in your power. However, you must not lay a hand on Job himself." So Satan went out from the Lord's presence. One day when Job's sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and reported, "While the oxen were plowing and the donkeys grazing nearby, the Sabians swooped down and took them away. They struck down the servants with the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." He was still speaking when another messenger came and reported, "A lightning storm struck from heaven. It burned up the sheep and the servants and devoured them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." That messenger was still speaking when yet another came and reported, "The Chaldeans formed three bands, made a raid on the camels, and took them away. They struck down the servants with the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." He was still speaking when another messenger came and reported, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in the oldest brother's house. Suddenly a powerful wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on the young people so that they have died, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job stood up, tore his robe, and shaved his head. He fell to the ground and worshipped, saying, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will leave this life. The Lord gives, and the Lord takes away. Praise the name of the Lord." Throughout all of this, Job did not sin or blame God for anything. All right, so this first chapter, I was going to just kind of take kind of verse by verse, to kind of set up where chapter 2 all the way through 41, I guess, goes between the story of his three friends coming and the fourth friend, the younger guy that comes along and actually gets through to Job and gets his attention. So, verse 1, the land of Uz is sometimes identified with the kingdom of Edom, roughly the area of modern-day southwest Jordan and southern Israel. In Lamentations 4:21, it says, "Rejoice and be glad, O daughters of Edom, that dwellest in the land of Uz." And in Jeremiah 25, it's mentioned again, "And all the foreign people there, all the kings of Uz, all the kings of the Philistines, those of Ashkelon, Gaza, Ekron, and the people left at Ashdod, Edom, Moab, and Ammon." So he's from this land, kind of in southwest Jordan, and he's a very rich man and an exceedingly righteous man. The author of the book gives a really impressive description of a man. And you're right, Amanda. I brought a different Bible to my time, but this one says of perfect integrity, but other versions will say blameless. But he gives a description of a man who's obviously, we all know, is not perfect because there's only one perfect individual, but a man that was striving his best of his ability to serve God. Again, doesn't mean that he was sinless, but blameless. And there's a huge difference. You can kind of think of sin as vertical and blameless as horizontal. And Job lived before the watchful eye of all of his peers, just like we do. And in the same example we gave last week of being our elders being blameless, so that no one should be able to bring a charge of something against them. Job's character connection with God seems to be independent of any other Old Testament character. He definitely seems to live before the time of Moses, and why did we say that last time? Or, I'm sorry, before the time of Abraham?
Because he offered up sacrifices.
He offered the sacrifices himself, so the priesthood hasn't been established yet, and the promise hasn't been established yet. And let's see, what can I say? Oh, so who's another character in the Bible that it kind of comes out of nowhere and they call him a priest, and you don't really have any reference point of Melchizedek exactly. And he's mentioned in Hebrews. He's kind of this guy that's not an Israelite. Job's not an Israelite, but he's mentioned throughout the Bible as a priest, and he offered sacrifices. That's the kind of example you have here. So Job, that he's offering sacrifices for his family on their behalf, because he's the patriarch of the family. His possessions were 7,000 sheep and 5,000 camels, I think.
3,000.
3,000. So, yeah, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys. So, I could be wrong, but I would assume that 500 yoke of oxen means pairs. So that would be 1,000 oxen and 500 female donkeys. In Mosaic times, the Mosaic showed great sensitivity to animals. On the Sabbath, who rested with the individuals? The animals did as well. And much later in the book, we catch a glimpse of what Job actually did with his money. I mean, he was rich. That's how they, I mean, they didn't have money like we had. They had possessed animals, and that's how they obtained their wealth. So, Jason and Andrew, what is a cow go for normally now, the full-size cow?
$700
I mean, even today, a cow is valuable. I mean, $700 is a pretty penny.
I was about to say, this is a lot of, even in today's time. I mean, my dad's a cattle farmer. He doesn't have.
Yeah, exactly.
He doesn't have 7,000 cows or anything.
Yeah. What did you say? Oh. So, I mean, you even add it up in today's money, and he's wealthy in today's standards even. So what God had blessed him with was definitely an abundance. And we talked about in Job 29, we catch a glimpse, or Job lays out what he actually does with this money in his time and energy. He rescued the needy, cared for personally and handicapped and the dying. He brought orphans into his home, and he took the he took care of the underprivileged. So we can appreciate, a Christian can appreciate the perils of wealth in one's spiritual life, for sure. What's it say about individuals with wealth in the New Testament in Matthew 19? It says that, I tell you, it's hard for someone who is rich to enter the kingdom of heaven. And in Luke 12, and verses 15 through 21, another warning about worldly possessions. And he said to them, watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. And he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. Then he said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded of you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with everyone who stores up for themselves, but is not rich towards God. So, I mean, like I said, I think this is a very easy trap for us to fall into, and we don't even necessarily see that we're falling into it. I mean, I guarantee you, every person in this room would come to the aid of someone in need. But is it really easy to just keep, I'm 100% guilty of it, just keep accumulating possessions and possessions and possessions, just because we can. I mean, they don't even serve a purpose to me sometimes. I'll have it for a little bit, and then it'll sit in the garage for a year before we sell it in the yard sale, or give it to Goodwill. I mean, we just have this. As Americans, we're just so incredibly blessed. It's so easy for us to get caught up in the possessions of this world, and I think it's a real easy trap for Christians to fall into. And then we look at verses 4 and 5. His sons used to hold feasts in their homes and on their birthdays, and they would invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, perhaps my children have sinned and have cursed God in their hearts. This was Job's regular custom. So, three different times, and just the first chapter talks about Job's sons eating and drinking and partying. And I read about 10 different commentaries, and about half of them were split. Some were saying this was innocent get-togethers, and other ones were saying, no, these kids were totally out there living their life partying. What do you guys think as you read through it?
I think Job's nature, they were leading to they were trying to do right. I don't think they were partying. Because of his nature, he was the most perfect person who lived at that time, according to God. And so he wouldn't tolerate that.
Well,
and he prayed for them also, just in case they did sin.
Yeah, and that's the argument that the children were acting on the up and up, was that Job was an upright man. He wouldn't tolerate that under his watch. He would stand against that. But when you look at the first time it talks about it, in verse 4, it says that the sisters, and this may be minute, may not mean anything. It says that the three sisters and his brothers eat and drink with him. Then the next time it talks about it, it talks about him drinking wine. And I don't know, maybe it may be totally innocent, but for some reason he goes from the first one and then he mentions wine. What do you guys think? More discussion about it.
It was a common drink.
Yeah, I know. And it was used as a drink in those days without being alcoholic in the sense that we drink.
And Europe probably didn't burn, did many overdo it.
Yeah. What do you guys think? Do you guys think they were getting their party on?
That may be why he prayed for them, that they're not sin. They might have, just what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, for a man of wealth that has this many children, they probably have servants too, but they also have the ability to party on their birthdays, have their friends and family over, to have celebrations. And when you have 10 kids, that's at least 10 times that they're going to be getting together, not counting mom and dad's birthday or other religious feasts of things of that nature. So
yeah,
more than likely, they enjoyed the benefits of wealth like their daddy did.
Well, and the commentaries definitely mentioned that too, that it was a large family. And you guys have noticed from the second row back is all of my family. And this is what happens to us all summer long. We have about a birthday every week. There's somebody, we're going to a party somewhere. So like, yeah, they were talking about that very well could be innocent, that they were just getting together to celebrate with their family.
Well, if you look at who Job was and the idea of like being blameless and upright, and also him being involved enough in his kids' life to know when they were partying and to bless them when doing so, that causes, when it says it may or it might be that they sinned. If Job was that involved with what his kids were doing, he would know if they were sinning and cursing and doing whatever. So I don't think it would be that if it may be, because if he knew what his sons and daughters were doing, then it would be that they're sinning. And that's where like the wording there just makes me think that it might have been innocent.
Yeah,
Anna, do I know? I have no really big basis for this, but thinking about Noah, who was a righteous man, but he had shown him a Japheth, and one of them discovered his father's nakedness. I mean, kids are capable of, even though their father's instruction, are able to, you know, not follow in their father's footsteps. And even with David, with his children, you know, he was a good man, a man after God's own heart, but his children weren't faithful.
Yeah,
in the
Samuel
same way.
Too.
Yes. So, again, I don't really have much support for it, but I could see it being that Job was a faithful man, but his children, he has a lot of wealth, and his children are able to benefit from that. So I could see.
Yeah, I mean, whatever decision you make about it, it has no real bearing on the story overall. It's just interesting to think about. But you think about, and I heard you talking to David out in the hallway, Job's wife, you only hear from her one time in the whole story, and what's she telling Job?
Curse God and die.
Curse God and just go die. And so you don't know what kind of woman she was and what kind of relationship she had with their kids and what kind of family life they had. You don't get a real pleasant idea of her when she talks to her husband like that, but you never know. And so it could be either way.
What other factor here?
Yeah.
You gotta go back to the original. When Satan approached God, of course his sons were coming together, present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came along with them. Now Satan is already, from Adam and Eve, rebelled against God. He was the enemy of God's creation. And so he challenged God here. And we know as you get into the lesson how he challenged him. Now, God says, where have you been? He said, all over the world. And he got down to one Job. And what did he say about Job? Look at all the allocates he gave to Job. Now, just think of the reasoning. If God thought that Job's children was going to be the tool of the devil, I believe it'd been more pronounced. You need to think about that, because we need to look at this in a positive light. We don't need to go the enticement or what ifs with the devil. And he said, you test him, but just don't take his life. And everything, that means children and all. Yep. Did it not? Yep. His children and all. And so we need not fall into the clutches of the great deceiver and the liar, the devil. And I think that's the stage that we're dealing with.
I always wondered why he took the children but not his wife. I mean, his wife must be, I'm assuming, is the mother of the second round of kids. Maybe.
Satan already had her if she said curse God and die.
Yeah,
well, they both had a limited understanding of any type of life after death, is my understanding at this point in the story.
Mm-hmm.
He reasons it out. They discuss it. It's revealed later in the book. But at this point, there is no hope after death. That's the end. And so she may or may not be judged by God in that. Her understanding, at least early in the book when she said that, was of the same understanding. There's nothing after death. That's just it. There is no hope.
That you can argue with that as well, that for the first several chapters where Job's wishing for death, he wouldn't wish that if he had a true understanding of the future holds after death.
Right.
And just remember, this time, Satan hadn't been cast out of heaven. He still had a rapport with God. He still had an audience. But after Jesus' death and resurrection, he's kicked out. That we know the story from then on, which is more complete. But that tends to back up that statement.
Yeah, and that's what I wanted to move into in verse 6. It says, one day the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Who are the sons of God? Yeah, the angels, the multitudes of heaven. You can find verses on that in Genesis 6, 1 through 4. And again in Job 38. But interesting, if you turn to 1 Kings chapter 22, it says, therefore hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne with all the multitudes of heaven standing around him on his right and on his left. And the Lord said, who will entice Ahab into attacking Ramoth-Gilead and going to his death there? One suggested this and another that. Finally a spirit came forward, stood before the Lord and said, I will entice him. By what means, the Lord asked. I will go out and be a deceiving spirit in the mouth of all of his prophets, he said. You will succeed in enticing him, said the Lord. Go and do it. So now the Lord has put a deceiving spirit in the mouths of all of the prophets of yours. The Lord has decreed disaster for you. And I think you hit on a point there a minute ago that Satan did have an audience with God, but God used Satan only as much as he needed. He kept Satan reined in, but he used him in different ways to achieve his goal that he could see that Satan couldn't see. Satan couldn't see the end of this story. Or do you think if Satan could see the end of this story, he would have went along with this? He thought he was going to win. Just like when other time did he think he was going to win? When Jesus died. I mean, he doesn't see the big picture.
Actually, he thought what he had got hold of Judas. he done torn down his organization. And then when he